This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to the show, everyone. You're listening to Let's Go There with Shira and Ryan on Channel Q. And today is a special day. It is Ryan's birthday.
Yes, it is. Thank you all so much for, one, giving me the gift of listening to this show, because thanks so much. Yes. You don't have to. But yes, it's my birthday. I'm 27. I'm like super excited about it, even though my mom and everyone around me keeps rushing me to 30. It's like, what is happening here?
Yeah, that's how it works. Every time you hit that 7, 8, you basically round to the zero. Next zero there.
It's wild. I think really what my mom is trying to say is like, stop asking me for money. You are way past the asking for money phase of your life. So yeah, maybe I do need to figure things out. Who knows?
We know. Ryan, I'll give you on your birthday some words of advice from your elder.
I rather just have money. I don't need your words of advice. Just give me money, pay for a bill, Venmo me, cash at me, people. Don't give me advice.
Wisdom and dollars. Get it. I got that. All right.
That's
that actually
wisdom.
Helps because we have a lot that we need to talk about on the show. So enough of, I'm not going to drop any wisdom.
Oh, thank God.
For you. You can go to my Instagram for that.
No one.
Okay.
Don't
Coming
do
up
that.
On the show, we're going to be talking about these education pods that parents are starting for the new school season. And we're also going to be getting into mail-in ballots and what are the deadlines for the presidential election. Because that was being shared yesterday. So
yes,
we're talking
yes.
about that on the show to make sure you're ready. But let's get into some what's trending this hour. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg was asked about his censoring of Donald Trump Jr. today by Representative Jim Sensenbrenner. He's referencing the Nigerian doctor's viral video about hydroxychloroquine being a cure for COVID-19. Here's Mark's response.
It was reported that Donald Trump Jr. got taken down for a period of time because he put something up on the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine. Now, I wouldn't take it myself, but there still is a debate on whether it is effective either in treating or preventing COVID-19. And I think that this is a legitimate matter of discussion, and it would be up to a patient and their doctor to determine whether hydroxychloroquine was the correct medication, given the circumstances. Now, why did that happen?
Congressman, well, first, to be clear, I think what you might be referring to happened on Twitter, so it's hard for me to speak to that, but I can talk.
So everyone is sharing this and making fun of it because he was referencing something shared on Twitter, and Mark's like, it's on another platform. I don't own Twitter. I own Facebook.
I mean, which is honestly the best excuse ever, because it's true. He could have been avoiding the question, but...
Totally. He was. It worked out.
It worked out.
Now, Colorado's health department has launched an investigation into the use of ketamine in connection with the 2019 death of Elijah McClain in police custody. Now, we know that was such a sad story. Everyone has been sharing also on social media.
Yeah.
The 23-year-old black man died after paramedics administered the anesthetic during a confrontation with police. And of course, he later died. The Department of Public Health and Environment, which certifies emergency medical responders, said in a statement today that it's investigating numerous complaints that provided new information regarding ketamine administration in August 2019.
And let's also be clear, Attorney General William Barr found out about this story for the first time, had no clue about this young man, and didn't even know about the use of ketamine. There's a viral clip happening from his hearing yesterday. Please check that out, because it was so damaging to know that he had no clue about that and the force that police officers, non-medical professionals, are saying, you know, are using ketamine to actually, you know, calm people down. It's absolutely ridiculous.
All right, let's move on to VP Joe Biden, who wasn't giving anything away when it came to his VP choice, but he did talk about at least one leading contender, California Senator Kamala Harris. As he took questions from reporters yesterday, he held these notes that were captured by an Associated Press photographer. Now, this picture went viral. Harris's name was scrawled across the top, followed by five talking points. It's like, how do you do this by mistake? That's the thing. You know, there are people everywhere. I feel like, do you think this was a little carrot?
Well, it could be a little bit of a leak. I think we've seen that actually come out a couple of times from people in his camp, just like little leaks here and there. But I don't know. I don't know if it's that big of a deal, to be quite honest. The decision will be made.
It literally said VP. It said Kamala Harris, VP. So it also said, do not hold grudges. Campaign with me and Jill. Great help to campaign. Great respect to her.
Yeah. I think, you know, until they make the official announcement, and we're actually going to be talking about this a little bit later on coming up next with our Drexel Hurd, because I honestly just want him to figure it out and just make the announcement already.
Yeah, it's the epic tease. All right, we're moving into top stories in pop culture and entertainment news now. What is the tea?
All right, here are some pop culture stories that are trending right now. Madonna is at the top of the list because guess what? She has her whole Instagram has been flagged for spreading false COVID-19 information. Yesterday, Instagram obscured a video from the superstar's account for touting a conspiracy theory that claims a cure for the coronavirus has been found and proven and has been available for months. Basically, the caption read this: they would rather let fear control the people and let the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Yo, Madonna, she's always doing something weird and strange, but I guess she's an icon, so everyone ignores it. Let's actually ignore this story. We're going to move forward. Because,
go for it.
Actually, this is a sad story, but hopefully it brings some closure to a lot of people. Regis Philbin's cause of death has been revealed. A beloved TV host died from a heart attack. His family actually issued a statement mourning his death after his passing, saying, "We are deeply saddened to share that our beloved Regis Philbin passed away last night of natural causes, 1 month shy of his 89th birthday." So, yes, now we know the cause of death, and it's so sad. Everyone is still very much grieving, and those are your pop culture stories that are trending.
So sad. Now, coming up, there are less than 100 days until the presidential election. We break down everything you need to know before you mail in your ballot. That's next. There are less than 100 days until the presidential election, and it's going to be one like we've never seen before, that's for sure. And back with us is Democratic political strategist Drexel Hurd. As we break down what we need to know going into this election season, even though we're in it, we're in deep at this point.
Oh, yeah, I can't believe but... the time is flying by, to be honest.
So, Drexel, how is this election going to be different from anything we've ever seen, and what should voters expect?
Well, hey, first off, thanks for having me back, and happy birthday, Ryan.
Yes,
thank you.
What a great day to be on today. You know, look, like you said, we're less than 100 days away from this election. We've got a lot of work to do. I think by week we'll know who Vice President Biden is going to be choosing as his running mate.
I mean, I hope it's been taking forever. And all these pieces about, oh, he's choosing this person. He might be choosing this person. Like, girl, what are you waiting for?
Well, you know, I know everybody has, you know, we live in this world of where things are quick and we want things instant. And, but the fun thing about, at least for us politicos, is the speculation piece about it beforehand. Mm. And that is, and that's what you've seen over the past few weeks. You know, somebody texted me today and said, oh, do you think that was a mistake that, you know, they got the picture of Biden's notes? Or I say, well, there's always going to be red herrings out there. There's always going to be this idea of just putting it out there just because and giving people fodder to talk about.
True.
And next week, you know, we'll see what happens and it may surprise people. But what you've seen over the past few weeks is the vice president continue to roll out policies that make a difference. Just this week, again, he talked about the Build Back Better plan. the economic plan that's focused on manufacturing jobs and working families and entrepreneurs and small businesses, and how best we can, how best that his from his plan that we can make America actually great again. And of course, the vice president's plan, Lift Every Voice on Black America. So there's a lot of plans, and everybody can go to joebiden.com because the vice president will continue to roll those out over the next few weeks. As long as Democrats stay on message, and I think you're seeing that from all of the candidates who have coalesced around the vice president and his candidacy. Just this week, 2 days ago, the DNC settled on the platform that's going to the floor. So we're starting to see Democrats try to figure out what our message is going to be going into the fall against the president. And then Democratic voters are just, we're going to have to do our jobs just to make sure that Democratic voters understand that message. And that while we you know, we don't want to dumb down things, we do have to do a better job of simplifying things to where, you know, Americans who are inundated with information can understand a little bit better. So that's what I think that we're going to be focused on over the next 100 days.
You're again hearing from Democratic political strategist right now, Drexel Hurd, as we look at, you know, the next, how many days? I'm like 100, whatever, how many days? Or like, we're at 98 or 97 days?
It's 90.
At this point in the election.
Tuesday, Wednesday, 97.
We obviously, did any of us?
97 days.
I think that's right. You know, and I think as we're getting closer, a lot of people are wondering, is Biden going to do this? Because I think we're seeing, you know, President Trump, he restarted the coronavirus briefings, especially after he had that sit down interview on Fox News with Chris Wallace, where he was shown the facts about the Fox News polls. So showing that he hasn't handled, you know, voters feel like he hasn't handled the coronavirus pandemic, like in a way that, you know, Joe Biden would have probably handled it a lot better. So what do you think about this? Is this, you know, him bringing back this coronavirus briefing? Do you think that's more of a strategy on his part to show people that he has this stuff under control?
Well, I think that there is always going to be a strategy to, or at least some sort of narcissism to this president. He hasn't been out there doing rallies. Nobody's been really positively talking about him. And he feels like he's the one that can break into this positive message about himself. And he said that from the beginning. He's his best messenger, which is why, you know, he sidelined the press press secretary for a couple of, for almost a year. To where he became the messenger. And in this case, you know, while he continues to try to go out there with the message, he gets sidelined by messages that that he just thinks off the top of his head. And it's a distraction. He doesn't know how to focus on what actually matters. You know, you just saw over the weekend, you know, him put out a thing about the doing the first pitch at the Yankees game. You know, because Anthony Fauci did it at the Nationals game.
That's amazing.
And then he had to walk it back because the Yankees never actually invited him.
You know, so he's basically, we all know he's like the lying. It's crazy. I just want to ask you, Drexel, with mail-in voting, how early do voters need to send in their ballots? Because I think that that's been shared a lot on social media also.
Sure. That's a good question. So I know here in California that mail-in ballots will drop in October, probably around October 20th. You know, yesterday was National Vote by Mail Day, just to remind people, and you saw a tweet from the president, President Obama, I'm sorry, about the deadlines that are coming up. You know, if you are in California, 10/27 is your deadline to request, October 27 is the deadline to request your vote by mail ballot. If you're in Florida, it's 10/24. If you are in some of our key states of Michigan, it's October 30th. And Pennsylvania, it's October 27th. So, you know, as long as people know to request their mail-in ballot in October or by the date, then I think we should be okay. But it's about returning that ballot as well. In a lot of states, especially here in California, you know, our state is paying for postage. You don't, all you got to do is fill it out and then pop it to the box. That's it. You know, and obviously people should not be discouraged by the news from USPS. You know, your ballot's going to get in. Somebody asked me today how long it's going to take to get election. You know, here in California, they'll start to count early. And so people, you know, make sure you get your ballots back in and make sure you're registered in time to get those ballots.
All right. Drexel Hurd, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Drexel is a Democratic political strategist. We always love having him on. Now coming up, can you believe it, Ryan? The school year is here. And even if kids aren't going back to the classroom, could learning pods be the best option for students? Find out next. Many children aren't able to return to the classroom, so could learning pods be a safe alternative? We know about the virtual classes, but learning pods, this is something new. Joining us now is Dr. Jim and Dr. Liz Dexter-Mazza. They're psychologists, husband and wife. We love them. They've also developed a social emotional learning curriculum called dbtinschools.com. Check it out. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us again.
So what are learning pods? Like, I was thinking of them as like physical pods, like,
oh my God,
meditate in.
Of course you did.
Something like that. But what are they? And is this something that is arranged by or by schools?
Yeah, I think there's a variety of different ways that people are defining learning pods. First, they're talking about like learning pods in like small classroom groups that they can engage either virtually or in schools. And then there's like family learning pods where families might either be doing distance learning with a group of kids, but maybe three or four kids are in one house on one day where they're doing virtual learning all with the same teacher, but maybe because we're at one house, the other two parents can go to work that day. And then another day, the three kids go to another house. So that's another way learning pods are getting defined. And then the other piece is where they're looking at grouping small groups of kids that they can bring into the school for some socialization in small groups of five or six kids. So a big part is that there's multiple different definitions of what we're talking about in regards to learning pods. And then there's the piece of some families hiring their own individual tutor or teacher to come in and teach a classroom of five kids when they pool their resources.
And that's not realistic for everyone. Obviously, the hiring of private tutors feels so, I mean, you're obviously segregating a large group of people, especially when you're hearing stories about a 15-year-old in Michigan, her name is Grace, who was incarcerated and is currently incarcerated because she didn't do her online schoolwork. So a judge decided to send her to juvenile detention. So can we talk a little bit about that and how this type of learning pod, especially when it comes to the private tutoring, it really does kind of reveal a lot of this equality disparity that's going to really happen and take place.
Yeah, I think it really does. And, you know, I think that we're still using some of our old outcomes. You know, the person didn't do her home, the 15-year-old you're talking about in Michigan didn't do her homework, and to be incarcerated for that just seems like that's kind of pretty conservative, old school type of thing, right? And so we're kind of in just a newer world that way. And so, you know, I think that we want to try to integrate the pods as much as we can. And I think the article that we read talked about some of that. It's challenging though. So are we going to, you know, some of our schools have kids that, you know, live 3, 4, 5 miles away. They used to get bused. And so how are we going to integrate those pods? So there's some diversity that's there. There's diversity in income as well. And then to allow for some of that socialization piece.
And even harder when you've got schools and kids who travel anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour to school.
Yeah.
They live in remote areas. You know, that trying to do any kind of in-person will be hard. Virtual pods may be more likely. But again, we're widening that equity gap the more we look at going by private sector and letting families do it or neighborhoods do it or high wealth school districts being able to do it versus low wealth school districts.
Yeah. Again, we were talking to psychologists, Dr. Jim and Dr. Liz Dexter-Mazza about these pods for kids to learn and if it's a safe alternative. And I totally get what you're saying. I think that this is definitely a worry. What happens to low income students, right? Like, are you leaving them behind and does this continue the education gap?
Possibly, right? And so if some of our low-income students aren't already, if they don't have the equipment or reliable internet, they're already being left behind by the current virtual school, right? If the learning pod, if it's even done in person or if it's done in small groups, it can be done at a school or at a library, different ideas, we're at least trying to catch them up some. We're trying to reduce the amount of gap that they're going to experience in this next academic year. Is it going to get all the way back and reduce the gap completely? I doubt it. I don't think that that's there. I think that there's some of our more wealthy schools and well-resourced schools tend to have different types of teachers, have more resources to provide for students and smaller classrooms and so forth.
So, and I think just, go ahead.
No, you can go.
I said, looking for opportunities for this to be a community intervention that accesses the whole community, not just individual family interventions.
Yes.
I think it's going to be a big part of the key, looking at community centers, boys and girl clubs, YMCAs, libraries, to pull some of that learning in together.
Shouldn't education boards be responsible as well? Because it feels like there's obviously no plan besides just getting kids back into schools, and they're not going to be opening up safely and all, let's just be honest here. And so where does the responsibility really land when it comes to these Board of Educations?
I think it lands on them significantly. And they are so far behind that they don't even know what they're doing in 3 weeks for many of them, whether they're going back in person or remotely, that to even think about the next step is further away. And I think they have to be.
I think it's a tough position, right? I think they're caught flat-footed. I think in March, everybody assumed that we'd just be back in person, that we'd be done with this. We'd shut down for a month or so. And they were planning on that piece, right? And now we've got an A, B, and C plan. And we've got all in person, we've got a hybrid, and we've got all virtual, right? So that's kind of been the primary. And now they're starting to see that maybe that's not gonna work either. There wasn't enough planning, enough visibility to see that this might actually be promoting more educational gaps. Right. What are we gonna do with our kids that have this, right? And so I think some cities have been good about saying, you know what, we're gonna take some of our money and we're gonna pay for technology for every single kid in their school, right? I think that's where it needs to go. And here's the piece where I think it's systemic is, our boards of education, our schools of education don't have enough money to do some of that, right? So we don't, as taxpayers, at least in the United States, we don't put enough money to education. If it's that much valued, then why aren't we paying?
I agree.
It's
crazy.
All right. Well, thank you again for enlightening us today on all of this. As expert parents and psychologists, we appreciate it.
We're always glad to be here.
They are a couple goals, by the way.
I mean, honestly.
Dr. Jim and Dr. Liz Dexter-Mazza, you can check out what they're up to. The site is dbtinschools.com. Now coming up, Trump wants to know why we like Fauci so much and not him.
He's
why?
Jealous. I love that.
We discuss that viral clip next in 10 minutes. During the White House's coronavirus briefing yesterday, President Trump went on a rant about why Dr. Anthony Fauci's popularity rating is up and his, well, isn't.
Perhaps you've seen it, where we're up here and the rest of the world is down at a level that's just a tiny fraction of what we've done in terms of testing. So it sort of is curious. A man works for us, with us very closely, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, also highly thought of. And yet they're highly thought of, but nobody likes me. It can only be my personality. That's all. Go ahead.
Could I just ask you?
I mean,
let's talk about this really, because I think there's a lot that we can joke about here, but let's talk about this shift in this tone of Trump, right? I think we are seeing this, a new Trump in these White House press briefings where he started to continue them because he's realized that people don't trust him. People do not see him handling the situation in the middle of this pandemic. They think, oh, he has been done terrible, and they feel like Joe Biden would have handled it way better. So he's trying to shift the tone. This is all strategy, right? This is not something that he is like, he's trying not to show how erratic he is. He's trying to show like, hey, I need to kind of convince my followers, the people who are going to vote for me, that I'm going to handle this correctly. So this moment where he's talking about, well, I don't understand why people like Fauci more, than he just can't help himself, right? He can't help himself not being narcissistic, to be like, why doesn't people like me? I feel like I've done a great job, when that is just not facts. It's not the truth. So many people have died.
I mean, I love how he says, it can only be my personality, that's all. It's not my actions at all. It's not looking at how I've treated this situation and the results of my actions that clearly don't add up.
You know, I wonder, did you catch when he was talking about the data? He was like, oh, you know, we have all this data that no one has seen. Well, of course no one has seen it, because guess what? The Trump administration issued that new rule, you know, requiring hospitals to shift their reporting, their daily data on COVID-19. Directly to the Trump administration instead of to the like apolitical CDC.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing with like, I'm going to show you my graph. Show us that graph, right? Show us that graph. I think the sad thing is, and we talked about this, what scares me is, say, if you're informed, if you're a skeptic, or you actually want to question things and verify if things are true that he's saying, then you would, right? And then you would see that a lot of the things, as we mentioned, don't add up. If you're just taking him for what he is, what he's saying, and he's saying it, he's trying to be very clear about what he's saying and very direct, even though it's very vague. My worry is someone would watch this who maybe has voted for him already and sees, yeah, these people are just, they don't like him. So they're just trying to drag him because they don't like him when he is doing the best he can.
Well, you know what I got to say to that? I just hope folks who are easily manipulated like that will wake up, because we have no time to play games. And honestly, this idea that, you know, oh yeah, he's being so mistreated in the media just does not work for me. It makes no sense, especially when the facts are there. And let's be clear here. The polls are saying that Joe Biden is, you know, winning currently. You know, Fox News polls are saying that they trust him more than they trust Trump. There's a chance here. And if we open our eyes and we open our minds and we stay dedicated to this cause of voting, we need to get Trump out of here. And that's really all that matters.
And I love how they say, he says he has a great relationship with Fauci. Well, then how would he not know his stance on hydroxychloroquine? He's like, I have a great relationship, but I don't know his stance on like one of the major things that people are talking about that could be a cure that has been thrown around and people are picking up on. That doesn't make sense. So let's just, as we wrap things up, speaking of the polls, where it's at, Quinnipiac University poll released on July 15th, 65% of respondents say they trusted the information Fauci provided about the virus. 30% said they trusted information from Trump. 30%, that's still like a pretty decent number of people that trust the information coming out of that.
It's not good, though. It's not a good number for him.
It isn't. It's still something.
Yeah, but it's not a good number. That's a number that that's the reason why we've seen him return to these press briefings and the tone has changed. That's why. That's not a good number.
All right. Well, coming up, Texas Representative Louie Gohmert just tested positive for COVID-19. Turns out he didn't wear a mask during yesterday's bar hearing either. Find out more in What's Trending This Hour. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Let's Go There with Shira and Ryan on Channel Q. And a reminder tonight, Dr. Chris is talking about work from home burnout. We all know it too well, don't we?
How
that could potentially affect our effectiveness at work.
I mean, the amount of times that we've talked about it here, yeah, I'm pretty sure. It's going to be actually probably such a good conversation with Dr. Chris, too, because he's going to really go there and give some tips that people can probably really need to survive. I would be tuning in, but today's my birthday, so.
You have a good excuse. He's also got the question of the night, which is always up on their IG page every day at Loveline. Go check them out, because that show, I grew up with that. Being here in LA, at least.
Yeah, but it's completely different than what you grew up on. But I feel like it's a little bit
better. It's even better with Dr. Chris, our favorite person.
And yes, we were paid for that sponsorship.
Mm-hmm. A lot of big money. We are rolling in the dough.
I'm just joking. No, we love Dr. Chris. So, of course, we always want to tune you in to what you can expect here at Channel Q.
Now, let's get into some What's Trending This Hour. President Trump spoke in Texas today, ending a rule on suburbs. I love this. Enjoy your life. If you can, of course, afford a home, have a job, or have access to education and health insurance, enjoy your life. Enjoy your life. We won't have anyone coming into your suburban neighborhoods and ruining it for you.
It's not going to happen. And by the way, I just ended the rule on suburbs. You know, the suburbs, people fight all of their lives to get into the suburbs and have a beautiful home. There will be no more low-income housing forced into the suburbs. I abandoned and took away and just rescinded the rule. It's been going on for years. I've seen conflict for years. It's been hell for suburbia. We rescinded the rule 3 days ago. So enjoy your life, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy your life.
Now, Representative Louie Gohmert on Wednesday suggested that he contracted coronavirus because he wore a mask more frequently in recent days. He said in an interview with the American Independent, "I can't help but think that if I hadn't been wearing a mask so much in the last 10 days or so, I really wonder if I would have gotten it." So this is a guy that talked about not liking masks at all for a while. Meanwhile, he did appear at the Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday without a mask. He was shot a few times with that mask. He said that he had a mask on, but he was shown talking to Attorney General William Barr without a mask.
Well, technically he didn't have a mask on if he was like shown without the mask at times. So like you were on and off wearing your mask, and look, this is what we see. This is why you have it now at this point.
Yeah.
Sad.
And Nancy Pelosi has called out that it's unfortunate unfortunate that some people like him, some Republicans, are going around with without a mask, and they're continuing to work in this way while having COVID-19.
Yeah, now everybody in that building needs to get tested immediately because, dude, are you kidding me? He could have affected so many people.
Yep. And with no coronavirus relief bill yet, California state lawmakers are debating on whether to provide a supplemental unemployment benefit with the extra $600 provided by the federal government expiring this month. Assemblyman Phil Ting from San Francisco, the leader of a legislative working group, said there is support among Democratic lawmakers for providing up to $600 weekly to jobless Californians if Congress fails to act on extending the federal pandemic benefit. And yes, as we all know, with the HEALS Act, even if they do something, they've said $200.
We're still screwed.
Yeah, so we need to figure that out. But now I guess the states are going to jump in on that to support the rest of the money, perhaps. I don't even know where they're going to get that money.
Yeah.
All right, we're moving into top stories in pop culture and entertainment news. What is tea, Ryan?
Okay, so we have some fun pop culture stories that are trending right now here in the Tea Report. Let's start off with Post Malone because, you know, everyone's getting creative with the hustle in quarantine.
Oh, yeah.
They're trying to make some money. Well, Post Malone is taking steps to turn his favorite drinking game into a huge business. So we basically learned that the rapper is looking to lock up the rights to World Pong League. And Post and his legal team have gone so far as to file for a trademark on that name. According to the docs obtained by TMZ, Post Malone wants his World Pong League to operate official beer pong tournaments, competitions, events, and exhibitions. So, yeah, that is right. You heard that Post Malone is trying to start a World Beer Pong League. Wow.
You know, I love this. I love his entrepreneurial spirit. I'm surprised that someone hasn't trademarked that yet after enough drunken games of beer pong. Someone hadn't been like, yo, dude, like, we need to make this into an official thing.
It goes with his brand because his last album was beer pong, beer bongs and Bentley. So it kind of works with that. But yeah, let's move on because I got to talk about this epic clapback from Barbie, the company, and how they responded to Donald Trump Jr.'s diss. So basically, Barbie has a 2020 campaign team, and it's made up of four diverse dolls, including a candidate, a campaign manager, a fundraiser, and a voter.
Love it.
So
okay. It
was all unveiled to expose girls to public leadership roles and pique their interest in shaping the future. So, of course, Donald Trump Jr. used this, this moment to take a shot at Democrats. He tweeted, "Voter Barbie must be a Democrat because she's already wearing an I voted sticker. And yet she's got another ballot in her hand." So, obviously, with the negativity that Donald Trump Jr. is putting out into the world, Mattel spokesperson tells TMZ, "Barbie is not and has never been affiliated with a political party. Barbie has always encouraged girls to stand up for what they believe in and shows them that they can be anything." And a lot of people are associating that clapback with the whole AOC situation that's happening right now. So those are your pop culture stories that are trending, honey. I love to see it. You're welcome.
How low do you need to go to attack Barbie?
Yeah, it's pretty
gross. It's a doll. Just let kids believe in a dream, okay?
Pretty gross.
Now, coming up, eviction protections are running out and Democrats are proposing new protections, but how quick can they be put into action? We discuss that next in 10 minutes. A wave of evictions is coming and Democrats are proposing a lifeline. Representatives Ayanna Pressley, Rosa DeLauro, and Senator Kamala Harris introduced a bill, the HELP Act, Housing Emergencies Lifeline Program, to fund legal assistance for Americans facing eviction. But when could it take effect and will it actually work or be too late?
Yeah.
Here's Ayanna Pressley on MSNBC.
Many people were surprised to learn just how many families were already on the precipice that did not even have $400 saved to weather a disruptive life event. And so this hurt has already been existing. It's only being exacerbated in this moment. Our GOP colleagues in the Senate, I'm not sure if they're cruel, callous, clueless, or all three.
And with us right now to break this down is Corianne Payton Scally, Principal Research Associate in the Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Thanks again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's break down the HELP Act. What would it help with?
Well, I think we're definitely seeing an eviction crisis on the horizon. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are struggling to pay their bills, including their housing costs, whether they rent or own. and they need some help. And so there are a lot of different proposals out there right now. And of course, past actions that Congress has taken to try and delay people being displaced from their homes and trying to provide resources to help them pay the rent.
Yeah. And just to mention, it would allocate $10 billion in emergency solutions grants, provide funding to states and localities for programs relating to things like homelessness prevention and outreach, to go towards funding legal representation for those who, as you mentioned, are on the verge of being evicted, among other things.
I think one thing that's obviously been in the conversations are eviction moratoriums, right? Mm-hmm. Why not just go ahead and do one? Could you talk about the positives and the negatives to something like that? Are there any negatives?
Sure. So eviction moratoria are great temporary solutions in the face of an emergency. They ensure that during a pandemic, people don't get moved out onto the streets in the middle of a public health crisis. What they don't do, though, is address issues of, say, the back rent that's stacking up in the background for tenants that have benefited from the eviction moratoria. But once those moratoria are over and expired, they have all of this debt racked up that they still can't pay.
Yeah. Corianne Payton Scally joins us again from the Urban Institute as we talk about this new bill, the HELP Act, proposed to help everyone facing eviction right now and the housing and homeless crisis right now in America. I also think it's interesting that they added this, that landlords will be required to inform tenants about their rights and responsibilities, which should be there already, and try to reduce the harm to tenants' credit. How important is this to include in a bill like this?
Yeah, so definitely there are negative repercussions of having an eviction on your record, so to speak. If you've faced an eviction before and the legal record exists and you approach a new landlord trying to find a new home, they can refuse to rent to you because of an eviction in the past.
And, you know, with reports saying America's nearly 43 million renters, about 20.8 million, that's almost half, were cost burdened. And you touched on a little bit about this. What needs to be done to help renters move forward, like actually being able to afford apartments and houses in the future?
Yeah, you touch on a great problem that existed prior to the pandemic, and that's almost 80% of households, you know, struggling to make ends meet that would qualify for federal housing help actually don't receive any help at all.
Wow.
So I think that we have a long-term issue of particularly households that are hardworking and just simply not earning enough to afford the housing in their area. Just needing some extra help in order to be able to stay stably housed. So the long-term solution is to help folks afford to pay their rent.
And how realistic is this that this is going to happen? I mean, I'm sure they have different hoops to go through to actually implement this.
Yeah, I mean, especially when the GOP is planning on reducing unemployment insurance, it already seems like they're not on the same page.
Yeah, it would definitely take a significant commitment, but I think that housing is a basic need that everybody needs access to, and that we honestly need people to be housed to keep our economy going. And so I think it's a worthwhile investment.
Yeah. I mean, because I was going to bring up, and one thing that I found super interesting about the article was it was talking about how landlords can afford lawyers, right? And renters often can't afford that, and that often hurts them in the end. Like, so what resources can really help them with that and obviously everything else?
Yeah, right now there's not many resources available nationally to help renters get adequate representation in eviction proceedings. A study in New York City done a while ago found that about 9 out of 10 landlords came to the proceedings with representation, whereas only about 1 out of every 10 tenants did. And this was prior to New York City implementing a new policy that guaranteed legal representation to tenants. So I do think that there would be a huge benefit to tenants from ensuring that their rights are also represented during the proceedings.
All right, a lot to look at right now. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, that was Corianne Payton Scally from the Urban Institute. Now coming up, are we on the verge of a vaccine war? We break down what vaccine nationalism is and how that could be affecting all of us next in 10 minutes. We are in a race to figure out a COVID-19 vaccine right now. There are actually more than 198 coronavirus vaccines in development, 19 which are in clinical trials. Experts say we could see something by the end of the year or early 2021, if we're lucky though. So as each country tries to get there first, could all this lead to a sort of vaccine nationalism?
That's a huge word. That is really
nationalism.
Big. Yeah, it's intense.
Dr. Amish Adalja joins us right now, who's a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, as we dive into what this actually means. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What is vaccine nationalism?
Vaccine nationalism is the idea that if a certain country develops a vaccine first, that they're going to make sure that their entire population is vaccinated before they allow that vaccine to be exported. And this is something that we've seen before, and it's something that we have to think about anytime there is an emerging infectious disease outbreak, an infectious disease emergence for which a vaccine is being developed.
Now, if there isn't this kind of global cooperation, because I think that's what's a part of this conversation, right? Where everyone has to be looking at more of a, like a way to work together versus just kind of being selfish in a way. What dangers could this have on everyone if there isn't global cooperation?
So we know that this virus has certain people that it causes severe disease in certain people, and that there are other people that are really high risk for contracting, like healthcare workers. And when you look at the vaccine, you kind of have to think, you know, how could we optimally deploy the vaccine around the globe to make the world safer from this virus, to get us back to some semblance of normalcy? And that often doesn't mean doing each country one by one. It means looking at the population as a whole and saying, there are healthcare workers in the United States, there's healthcare workers in South Africa, there's healthcare workers in Australia. Maybe they all should be first, and then high-risk individuals, and then we start thinking about the general population. And we sort of prioritize the vaccine globally for those individuals who being vaccinated would impact the trajectory of the pandemic the most, meaning that getting them vaccinated will get us closer to normal. So we want to get those core groups vaccinated first and then start moving to second tier priority groups.
But who would typically decide on this? Because it seems like what's happening is we have Russia that supposedly hacked the UK, the China. US and Canada, and China. And then everyone's kind of fighting to get there first, which I feel like I'm seeing like huge issues here, leading us to possibly like a vaccine war. So when you say like this decision would be made, that would make sense. Like who would ultimately make that decision? Like what other option could there be if we don't do what we're doing right now?
So what usually would happen is the World Health Organization would be the one that convenes a bunch of groups together and figures out who is the optimal people are that should get the vaccine first, and then kind of move from there. And we're doing that in the United States already. The Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, which is part of the CDC, has already made that kind of tiering for the United States, figuring out who the priority groups are. And I think you could take that and apply it to the world or something similar to that. And we tried to do that with H1N1 back in 2009, the last flu pandemic, but Australia was the first to a vaccine. And then they restricted export of their vaccine until their population was vaccinated. So, we had thought about this before, and you know that's why people are a little bit worried about what might happen, because it did happen during the 2009 pandemic, and it wasn't the United States that came up with the vaccine first. It was Australia, and we got our vaccine late. I remember getting vaccinated in November of that year after the peak of infection.
I didn't realize that. That's wild. Dr. Amish Adalja joins us again, who's a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, as we talk about this race to get a vaccine that could lead to vaccine nationalism.
The one thing that I'm thinking about in this conversation is the lower income countries. How will they be impacted? Because it doesn't feel like they are even being brought into this conversation when it comes to this race for a vaccine.
This is going to be a major challenge, because we know even when it comes to, for example, the measles vaccine, that the developing countries do not have enough vaccine to immunize their children. And during the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, Africa, for example, was a place where there was less vaccine available. And when it was available, it was very late. So this is something that we're thinking is going to be really important to solve this type of a problem. And there are organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that are working to try and bolster the supply chain for those countries. There are organizations, something called Gavi, which is a a big organization that's funded by donor countries, as well as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that help vaccinate children all over the world. And this is going to be a major pipeline for some of those developing countries. Mm. We're also seeing some of the countries like the United Kingdom, when they're making contracts to get vaccine for their population, they're kind of putting in waivers or riders into the contract saying, we want you to have more capacity than just for our country so that you can actually use it in the developing world. So I think it's going to be something that the people are really cognizant of, and hopefully we don't have the same repeats of what happened during the 2009 pandemic because of these organizations' efforts.
Is there an alternative to vaccine nationalism? What should we be looking for to wrap this up?
Instead of vaccine nationalism, we have to think about, you know, optimization of the vaccine, trying to realize that this is a pandemic that engulfs the whole world. And until this is controlled all over the world, we're never going to get back to normal. So it's not just about freeing your country of this vaccine. We have to free the world from this virus in order to get back to normalcy. And that may involve distributing the vaccine to those high-risk individuals, those priority groups, all over the world, no matter where the vaccine actually originates. The opportunity is here for vaccine diplomacy. Instead of vaccine nationalism, it's vaccine diplomacy. So we need to think about the vaccine as a tool to fix this problem and use it as a way to further diplomacy, not nationalism.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today again. That was Dr. Amish Adalja, senior scholar from Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Now coming up, could cameras in cars be an invasion of privacy or just keep you safe? The latest move one company is making that is raising eyebrows. Details on that in 10 minutes. You know that camera in your car that helps you be safe on the road, right? It like documents stuff. Well, some people have the camera. There's also a camera that helps you when you're backing up. I use that one all the time.
Yeah, that camera taught me how to parallel park, honestly. If I didn't have a rear view camera, then I would have never learned how to parallel park.
Or I would just bump into everything. Well, what if one of the cameras that was included in your car watched your every move? Would you be down?
Well, what do you mean by that? Because I feel like the only thing it would expose is how many people are rage drivers and they're cussing out the other drivers.
We get more viral videos out there. Well, there's this tech firm, Cerence. They have this strategy that they've pitched to their investors that has gotten out, I guess. Vice.com reported about this. They want to basically record every movement, every glance, every smile, frown, and wrinkled brow of drivers around the world. And you see, I'm not against this. I'm not against like using this data to then, it's like AI that then if they see you do something before an accident or do something before you make a dumb move, then they can help you not make that dumb move. The issue I have here though, Ryan, is they want to sell that data for profit.
Well, that's what they do with every app and everything. Like, that's all in the fine print. I think that's why people don't like it, because it's an invasion of privacy. I don't like this. I don't need you to, any AI or anything that's telling me. I barely like Siri or my Google Home. Like, they're always listening. They're always doing it. It already feels invasive. And so the idea of, like, it being in my car in a personal and kind of intimate space, I don't know how helpful that is. And also, algorithms are not the nicest to Black folks or brown folks. So let's be honest.
I mean, that's true. Listen, we know the AI, the facial recognition technology, and how it creates definitely these biases. Listen, if you're going to mess up and put your kid in the back seat and like not, you know, put them in their, what's it called? Their seat properly, right?
Car
what's
seat?
It called? That seat?
Wow.
That-
Cheers. Most definitely a future mother.
Like, or you're going to leave your kid there when you, like, it's hot outside, right? And overheat them in your car. I think there definitely should be technologies.
I mean, that just sounds like a gig for child services. I don't know if that sounds like a gig for AI. If you're leaving your child in the car on a hot summer day, you maybe need to rethink having children.
Probably.
Even though I have to say, my mom, she did it once by accident, but she said I was so quiet when I was a baby, she forgot I was in the back seat. And so I was out there just knocked out, sleeping. But it wasn't too hot. But, you know, things happen as new parents. You have to give
grace. So you weren't traumatized? Okay, good to know.
No, things happen. Give grace and space to parents.
Well, listen, I think we talk about this in terms of cars becoming smart cars, like we have our smartphone and smart TV. This is already happening. You go to the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas and you'll see these smart cars.
But so no I one's see going this, there, like on a regular person on a regular day is not going to those type of conventions.
But that is the future. That's where they announce the products products that will go out to market. So I see this happening. This isn't anything new, using AI to monitor your emotional state to help prevent anything. I'm down for that.
I
the worry I have and what we all need to be aware of is, what are these companies doing with our data? Right? Do you really want like ads in your car being pushed to you all the time? I mean, we already have, I mean, we're on the radio, obviously. We have ads, but I mean, like, there is this breakdown between your personal space and your tech space that's happening that is really scary. And the thing is, what scares me even more, Ryan, is the more we get used to it, the more we kind of like lose our boundaries around it. And it becomes normal.
I mean, I think you're making some valid points on the, if you're like a marketer, but I think when you're realistically a personal experience, I think this idea of this system learning your every move on how you're doing it so they can predict certain things ends up leading to some type of control, right? And I just don't like that, in the sense of it's taking people's free wills and free actions and all that stuff away from them. It could help, like you said, on the side of like avoiding accidents and all this stuff, but I don't know. There's a line that needs to be drawn when it comes to technology invading people's personal space, and this feels weird and invasive, and I'm not into it, but we gotta wrap.
Just keep it to, I'll keep it for myself, okay? All right, coming up, the latest COVID warning coming from the WHO, well, the World Health Organization. I'm sorry, I always call
the
it
WHO.
It's not the band. We have the clip next in What's Trending This Hour. Welcome back to the show. This is Let's Go There with Shira and Ryan on Channel Q. And reminder, Dr. Chris, our favorite doctor, of course, is talking about work from home burnout. I mean, it's something we're all going through, and he's going to get into how it could potentially affect our effectiveness at work. So if you are judging yourself and you are saying to yourself, things are harder these days, it makes sense. So don't be too hard on yourself, but he has the tools to help you get through it.
Yes, I cannot wait for that segment. He's so great at what he does. And so I love that. We're going to be now teasing some things, that some really cool things coming up, and either, you know, after the shows that's happening, maybe, you know, for the morning beat earlier next, you know, the next day. So it could be a cool moment. Like, we're all collaborating, Channel Q fam.
We're a fam, exactly. And you can follow at Loveline for all those updates. That show, of course, is right here on Channel Q Monday through Thursday. Now, here's some What's Trending This Hour. Dr. Margaret Harris, a spokesperson for the World Health Organization, said there is no evidence that COVID-19 will follow seasonal variations like other coronaviruses. And this comes after countries around the world are saying that they're experiencing second waves.
It does not seem to be affecting the transmission of this virus currently. What is affecting the transmission of this virus is mass gatherings, is people coming together and people not social distancing, not taking the precautions to ensure they are not in close contact. There seems to be this fixed idea about this virus being seasonal, but there is a huge outbreak that most intense, the highest numbers are being experienced in the USA. They are in the middle of summer. Also Brazil. They are in the middle of, they are an equatorial country. Southern.
Well, you heard it from her. It's not just because of the seasons. It's because people keep getting together in groups, not following the rules.
Yeah, sure. So she's kind of talking to you, you know?
Stop
it. You are someone
Ryan,
who has not so consistently.
This is a rolling joke. Let's be clear. This is a rolling joke on the show. Okay, where Ryan likes dragging me because I have like one or two people I hang out with that are in my bubble. And we are very safe and don't see anyone else. And we do wear masks when we go out and
practice
social distancing.
It's okay, Shira. Yesterday, you literally tried to say you didn't believe in the FDA. I'm just saying, it's a recurring thing. And, you know, it might be a recurring joke, but honey, the proof is in the pudding.
I'll let you get away with this drag today because it's your birthday. That's it. Now, President Donald Trump said he postponed his plan to throw the opening pitch at a New York Yankees game. However, the New York Times reported that both announcements took the baseball team by surprise because supposedly they never invited him.
Oh my God.
Okay. If we remember, Dr. Anthony Fauci is the one who threw the first pitch ahead of the Washington Nationals game against the New York Yankees. So I don't know where this whole, what's it called? This back and forth between Fauci and Trump. It's like the odd couple here.
Yeah, it's very embarrassing. It's like, what is happening? And I think it's just all motivated by jealousy from Trump. He's
yeah,
tired and over everyone loving Fauci more than him. It sucks to be disliked. I get it.
just do the right thing and maybe people will like you. Just do the right thing.
Yep.
Now on Tuesday, a video captured plainclothes NYPD officers loading a protester into an unmarked van during a demonstration. That video went viral, and now the NYPD has issued a statement saying that the protester was taken in by the warrant squad for, quote, damaging police cameras during five separate criminal incidents in and around City Hall Park. The NYPD later told NBC News that using unmarked vehicles for these types of operations is customary because a lot of people have been questioning the use of these unmarked vehicles, including during the Portland protests. Let's move into some pop culture news. What's the tea?
One, that story is so scary. If you see the video, whoa, it's like, it's alarming. But here are some pop culture stories that are trending right now. So let's move on to Tiffany Haddish. So she's tearfully revealing this heartbreaking reason why she's afraid to have kids. And she's 40 years old. And she's really wanting to start a family, but it turns out that she has this, she's basically like every other Black person in America has a reason, and her truth is so much, I mean, it hurts to listen to this. Here's a small clip of her thoughts.
It's like, I would hate to give birth to someone that looks like me and then knowing that they're gonna be hunted or killed. You know, like, why would I put someone through that?
So yeah, she's afraid, you know, why bring someone into this because of racism? If, you know, she feels like bringing someone that's going to look like her, a Black, another Black child, they're going to be hunted and all these things. Like, there's so a lot sad. To think about. It is really, really sad. And I send her so much love because, whoa, that clip really touched me when I initially saw it. So that was a lot.
Yeah. So when people say, oh, there's no racism in America, you know, you're in Hollywood, or you know, you now have the privilege and money or resources to take care of yourself. Like, it's all just, it's from the past. It's in the past. Look at this moment. This woman, you know, crying, sharing her heart, the fact that she has fear to bring a life into this world. And tell me that, and deny the fact that this still exists.
I know. Oh my gosh, chills. But let's move on to some other pop culture stories that are trending. So Kylie Jenner has a new piece of home decor that may cause a huge rift between her sisters. So taking to her Instagram on Tuesday, the youngest of the Kardashian clan revealed that she is now the keeper of her mom's wax figure. Which, okay, cute, I guess. Now they're going to be arguing over which Kris Jenner wax figure they want in their house, which is kind of weird.
Who would want one of those? Yeah. Like, let her keep it.
So weird. I'm like, that is awkward. Moving past that story, because who cares? The Emmys are going virtual this year, by the way. And I think we talked about the Emmys and the noms yesterday. But the Emmys have just been announced that Jimmy Kimmel is hosting it, of course, and they are going virtual. So expect the Emmys to look like one big ass Zoom call. You're welcome. And those are the pop culture stories that are trending right now.
Now coming up, are Republicans trying to use the coronavirus relief bill for a new FBI building? What is going on? Details on that in 10 minutes. We all know this week that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell pitched the HEALS Act for coronavirus relief. What we didn't know is that part of that bill would go to the construction of a new DC headquarters for the FBI. Questionable, right? Well, at a news conference Monday, McConnell initially denied that the FBI money was in the bill, but then was notified by reporters that the language was in fact included.
Why is funding for the FBI building in this bill?
I'm not sure that it is it? Look, I think this is a starting place. You can see that we've had a lot of our members involved.
Here with us is business reporter Jonathan O'Connell for The Washington Post. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so why would something like this be put in a relief bill?
That is a good question. And obviously a number of senators, including Leader McConnell, are confused about why it's in there. And those that have defended it have sort of, you know, acknowledged that it's a pretty weak or non-existent link between needing a new FBI building and the pandemic or responding to the pandemic. But it is still in there as of right now.
Wow.
Well, the interesting thing is that the White House press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, was pressed on why this coronavirus stimulus bill included this $1.75 billion for a new FBI building. She was asked about this over and over again. She made up excuses, but she couldn't say why it was in this bill, but said that it's not a deal breaker. So is this showing that this administration is not seeing this as a big deal? Because obviously this is very weird.
I think almost everybody in both parties acknowledges that it's weird. I mean, there are so many moving parts in the legislation, from health issues to, you know, unemployment insurance running out and trying to help people with that. And obviously the country faces so many deep problems at this exact moment. So it is really strange and odd to have a $1.8 billion provision in there for a building that, you know, is badly needed, but has been badly needed for 10 to 15 years. And for the administration to insist that it be in there right now is confusing. I don't think we'll really know how much they really want to stick to that. And, you know, maybe we'll know later this week. But I mean, a lot is happening every day right now, so it could come out, but maybe they'll try to stick to it.
Yeah. Jonathan, do you think that they thought no one would notice this?
I can't imagine they didn't think. I mean, I do think that when Mitch McConnell was standing there, Senator McConnell, I don't think that he knew it was in there. I think
how could he not know, considering he's the one who proposed the bill?
No, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, different senators have responsibility for different parts of the bill, and then the full thing goes through the leader's office, mm-hmm. or the leadership office. But I do think that there's more reporting to be done about how exactly it got in there, because this is not the president's bill, as you mentioned. This is the Senate Republicans' bill. They put it in there. They have requested that money. And I think we need to learn a little bit more about who wanted it in there and who sort of made the ask.
Yeah, again, Jonathan O'Connell joins us. He's a business reporter for The Washington Post. I was also going to ask, as you mentioned, it seems Senate Republicans are saying it wasn't them. So was it the White House? Because it seems like they're blaming it on the White House for sliding in, and how would that even be possible?
Yes. I mean, I think the White House has made, well, going back a little bit, President Trump has some sort of ongoing focus or almost fascination with the FBI headquarters, because he's brought it up at a couple other different times the last few years.
Yeah.
Strange times. I mean, sometimes it'll be in like budget discussions or appropriations discussions, but you know, this is the sort of thing that takes a lot of planning to figure out where you're going to put a very secure and important facility. And he just kind of throws in requests for money occasionally here and there without really, you know, doing the planning ahead of time or really explaining his request. And this is another example of that. And people haven't really, I don't think that he or the administration have really explained their thinking on it at any point.
Well, and I want to bring up one of those times you mentioned. In 2018, Democrats on the House Oversight Committee actually wrote in a letter saying that Trump had this clear interest in this FBI property. His interest became ensuring no other developer could buy the property, convert it, and compete with the Trump Hotel. So this is what Democrats are alleging. Is there a possible illegal situation happening here, especially if he's trying to not have it compete with the Trump Hotel? If that's true,
there is definitely a potential conflict. Absolutely. I mean, so there's definitely a potential conflict of interest here, which a number of Democratic senators and members of Congress have been sort of repeating over and over again. Obviously, the president's hotel is about two blocks from the FBI headquarters. And under the plan for the FBI that Trump inherited, that site would have been redeveloped into all sorts of things, housing, condos, hotel, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very large downtown site. So, we do know that his staff at his business before he became a presidential candidate was concerned about a hotel opening across the street at some point. Now, whether that remains the president's focus this time, 3 or 4 years later, and that is still remains an interest of his, is unknown. The White House has denied it. The president has resigned from his business, although he still owns his stake in that hotel. And his company has been, you know, trying to sell that hotel also. So, it's murky. And to be honest, there is an ongoing investigation by the Department of Justice Inspector General, but it's been going on for a year and we have still not been released. So we do not know yet what they have kind of come up with.
All right. Well, Jonathan, thanks for joining us for this today.
Oh, thank you all so much for having me.
Yeah, I love your enthusiasm for these dense topics. Again, Jonathan is a business reporter for the Washington Post, Jonathan O'Connell. All right, coming up, the Trump administration is trying to end DACA once again, but can they? Find out next in 10 minutes. The Trump administration announced that it is considering trying again to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA, and won't be accepting new applications. But wait, hasn't the Supreme Court already blocked this from happening? What's going on? Jose Munoz joins us right now, National Communications Manager at United We Dream. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, excited to be here.
So how can the administration do this after the recent ruling against it?
Yeah, so you know what you shared at the beginning of the segment here is that we had this really great, amazing victory in June, just last month.
We're losing track of time. Don't worry.
After the Trump administration tried to end the program in September of 2017, and you know it was really exciting. I had the opportunity to be outside of the Supreme Court as that happened, and it was really a testament to the power of young people. You know, it was young people that were organizing during the Obama administration to get him to stop the deportation of young people, and it led to what became DACA. And obviously, under this administration, undocumented people, immigrants as a whole, are one of the groups of folks that the administration has continued to attack. And what we're seeing is just that. Like, it's very clear that Trump is wanting to just go out of his way to make life as difficult as possible. And this really is this next step to try to circumvent the Supreme Court decision. You know, prior to the memo that was issued by the administration this week to really start to dismantle DACA, prior to that, the administration had refused really to issue any sort of guidance about how they would be following the Supreme Court ruling, which did push DACA back to where it was originally in 2012. And so what we saw this week with this memo is just exactly that, the administration wanting to circumvent their loss at the Supreme Court, which is really what that was. You know, it was their loss, and trying to, I think, really just continue to feed this anti-immigrant base that the president has and is continuing to move on.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is Trump said in a presser at the White House on Tuesday that he's willing to work with Congress on creating a merit-based system for immigration. What does that even look like? And is that really enough when you're hearing the president say something like that?
That really is nothing different than what the president has said in the past. You know, when he first ended DACA in 2017, it really launched what began a campaign for us here at United We Dream and others for a Clean Dream Act. And during all of those negotiations, that was a big part of what the White House was looking for. And really, when they're talking about merit-based immigration, I think what's really important for us to be able to call out is that they're really trying to limit the number of folks who are able to come into the United States. We've seen how this administration has tried to gut asylum numbers that are at some of the lowest that they've been in the history since we've been recording these numbers. And so it's really important to recognize that when we're talking about things like that, like, these are just buzzwords that are used by anti-immigrant xenophobes to try to limit who gets to come here. And that is what he's talking about. Like, that, let's pull the veil. Like, that is what's happening.
Yeah.
And so really what we're seeing is he's using DACA recipients as this sort of like bargaining chip to say, like, I care about these people. You know, in that presser that you mentioned, he was like, I'm going to make DACA very happy. Like, I'm a DACA recipient. I'm not very happy. Like, I'm very angry.
Yeah.
And I know that I'm not alone.
Jose Munoz joins us right now from United We Dream. So there are 700,000 unauthorized immigrants known as Dreamers who live and work in the U.S., immune from deportation, as we know. But what does this mean for them now? And you said you're one of them. Like, how does this feel when this back and forth is traumatizing, to say the least, and probably, like, I can't imagine living like that.
Yeah. So, you know, I've lived in the U.S. actually this year. I'll have lived in the U.S. for 30 years. I came to the U.S. when I was 3 months old. And I grew up in Minneapolis and I'm now in D.C. And so I've been here longer than, you know, like some of the institutions that are trying to deport us, like ICE has been around since 2003. I like to say that we will get rid of ICE before you get rid of me. Like, I'm here to stay.
And, period. Yes.
And so what it means for young people, like what it means for DACA recipients in this moment is, as we think about, you know, the new memo that was just issued, it means a couple of things. So basically, what it means is that USCIS is not going to be accepting any new applications for DACA, which was one of the biggest things that people were excited for. You know, you mentioned nearly 700,000 young people have DACA, yeah, but there's a lot of young people who were too young to apply before the Trump administration ended the program. Yeah. And so a lot of those folks actually became eligible to apply, you know, once the Supreme Court ruling came out. I think there was a lot of excitement about what that could mean. And so this new memo essentially gets rid of that totally. So no new applications are going to be accepted for DACA. It also means that advanced parole, which was a piece of the DACA program, which allowed folks to apply for the ability to actually leave the country for like a variety of reasons. You know, I had a lot of friends that had DACA and applied to leave the country to visit family members that they hadn't seen in years. Like when we're talking about family separation, like we have folks that family who may have been deported or different things like that. And so that's also, they're essentially rejecting all of those types of applications except for, you know, extenuating circumstances, you know, whatever that means. And then lastly, yeah, and this is one of the biggest things that I think is like very unnecessary and very cruel in addition to all of this, which is, DACA, you have to renew your DACA every 2 years. So like I've had it since 2013. And so every 2 years you have to renew it. However, effective immediately, all new renewals are going to be limited to 1 year periods of time. So instead of instead of having these renewals for 2 years, they're moving it down to 1 year. The reason why I want to highlight that is because I think it really showcases what the Trump administration is planning to do. And they're really setting themselves up for if they were to win re-election, like now they're having all these young people that are potentially getting renewals that are only really protected for 1 year. So they've really gut the protections that DACA recipients have from 2 years to one.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for being here and for your work that you're doing. I know there's a lot more to be done. Jose Munoz, again, is the National Communications Manager at United We Dream. Now coming up, the big Netflix announcement today that has everyone freaking out. It's basically like a birthday present for Ryan. That's next on our Yas Queen of the Day. We are wrapping things up with our Yas Queen of the Day.
Yes, Queen.
Shout out to Netflix. They've landed the streaming rights to several iconic Black sitcoms from the late 1990s, early 2000s. You might have been a big fan of these, grew up with some of these shows. Here's the announcement.
Joan, Tony, Maya, and Lynn.
Go home, Roger.
Are you ready to play some football?
Mo to the, E to the.
I am so excited
to announce
some really incredible, super exciting news.
One-on-one.
Half and half.
The Parkers.
Sister, sister.
Moesha.
The game.
Girlfriends.
Is coming to Netflix!
It's going down.
I am beyond humbled and honored.
Yes, Shira, you know, I know you're from Canada, but I have to say, Black people won a day. Honestly, Black and brown folks, if y'all have watched these shows and the history, you know, the late 1990s and the early 2000s was this Black renaissance that I feel like we are experiencing now again with so much amazing content and so many amazing great shows. And when people are talking about that, they're talking about these shows, they're talking about this moment. And so when, you know, when the news dropped about this, I mean, Twitter erupted. I am so grateful to know actually the social media manager and the person that's kind of in charge over the brand of Strong Black Lead. Her name is Jasmine. And
that's the Netflix account.
Yeah, yeah. It's a Netflix kind of segment account, Strong Black Lead, to really uplift all of their Black content, Black actors, Black actresses, really giving their flowers to these legends in our community. And this is such a huge situation. She was talking about on Twitter. She was like, I've seen so many tweets at me. I've seen so many tweets at the brand, and I've worked so hard getting all these amazing people. And the people in this clip were the actors and actresses from these iconic casts. So it's just like, it's a moment. Like this was such, it felt like a personal birthday present, to be honest. Cause you know, my birthday's not over.
It's Ryan's birthday. If you didn't know already, it is Ryan's birthday. I must say the one show I did watch a bit growing up was Sister Sister. Cause they had that on Friday night. Well, yeah. Nights.
Sister Sister was like the mainstream show.
Yeah.
Versus like the rest of those shows probably felt like it was on this network called UPN. And
we didn't have UPN in Canada.
Yeah. So it was like, it's very niche, but it's a part of the culture. It's a part of just Black history. And this is the best news ever. This is a huge Yas Queen. Shout out to y'all.
Yes, that was just for you, Ryan.
I know. All right, well, it had to be.
Well, that does it for the show today. How do you feel, Ryan?
I feel good. Today was a great show, right? You know, it's nice to, one, I felt like, you know, I guess in my ideal world, I would be off of work, not working. But today was really fun. It was nice, full of energy. Now I'm ready to go drink a little bit.
Hey, you deserve.
And sit by the pool.
I thought you already started drinking. I'm surprised.
No. I'm staying hydrated. I want my skin to be clear and good.
Nice. You are glowing. The birthday glow is here. All right. Well, coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about how coronavirus might actually be leading to better cities for disabled people and how the choice immigrants are facing in ICE detention centers, either to stay together or risk their lives. Mm. We're going to be talking about that tomorrow. Of course, we always go there. You can always expect we will go there.
Yes,
here.
Yes, we do.
4 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on Channel Q. We post everything as a podcast. By the way, join our podcast fam. Just go to the radio.com app and search Let's Go There and subscribe so you're notified when we post new episodes and interviews. We are sending you love and light.
And honey, remember to slay.
Have a great night. See you tomorrow and happy birthday, Ryan.
Oh, thank you. Bye, y'all.